whenever we have the evening puja, morning puja, when we make these daily formal gestures of respect and reverence, when we kind of gather together to express our commitment, our interest, our focus on Buddhist practice, then it's noticeable how the puja always centers around taking refuge, Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, that these are the centerpiece of the chanting. Yeah, so and this is not something that's insignificant or just happenstance. It's very deliberate that when we come together, we meet as a community, assembly of monastics, lay people, to have a kind of formal session of practice together to deepen our spiritual commitment. That deepening or that focus is formed around, or is introduced by, and informed by this recollection of the Triple Jewel. And as we recite the words and recount the qualities of Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, these are reminding us of their centrality as principles. Over and over again, in 25 years or so, 27, 28 years of in my life of reciting these same principles virtually every day for all this time. It's not like you're kind of wondering what's going to be the next hit tune, or you've heard that one already. Let's do something different, or let's update it, or change the words. It's the same old tune, the same old words, the same principles, reiterated again and again and again and again and again. So there's this huge reminder for us. This is like a major principle that's being brought into our attention, and we're focusing our spiritual development around. Yeah. And for very particular reasons. Like this evening, as probably most people here are aware, certainly most people are very aware that a couple of our friends up here for the weekend, Suhi and Dee, came over here for tea. We're just popping back to Dennis's house across the road, but they were planning to stay tonight, and just popping up the hill to leave their things and check in, and then come back for the evening puja, meditation, Dhamma talk, and climbing up the hill to Dennis's house on the other side of the valley. Then the car starts to get slower and slower, and starts as it begins to lose its grip and skid on the gravel, and then starts sliding backwards, flips over, and then traps the two of them inside. So then Dennis, having received a call that we're on our way, Dennis, we'll be there in a minute. Time went by and they hadn't shown up, so Dennis dutifully, skillfully, noticing that something was probably awry since they hadn't arrived yet, went scooting down the hill to find, to his horror, his house guests upside down in the ditch. Fortunately, the car not in flames. But certainly the two of them, Dee and Suhi, trapped inside. So, to cut a long story short, half the monastery turned out, and most of the neighbours appeared on the scene, plus police and the fire department volunteers and the fire truck, and got them out, and largely uninjured, apart from a bit of a bump on the head and a cut on a finger. Nothing too alarming, but still, this is not what you expect when you're just sort of popping over next door to drop your suitcases off. You were on our way. We're just here. We're just park our things and then get on with the next bit. We're here for the evening session, we want to hear the Dhamma talk. You don't realize you're going to be the subject of the Dhamma talk. Aha. This is why we recollect the refuges, because it's not just when it's somebody else, how unfortunate that they were overtaken by this sudden wave of anicca, these friends of ours. It's not like suddenly the anicca is stronger this evening than it usually is. There's more impermanence and uncertainty around. A sudden kind of whirlpool of anicca on the road up to 16740 on Tomkai Road. That, you know, that impermanence is everywhere. It's within all of us, around all of us. It is the very nature of nature. This instability and change, transiency, and it manifests in various different ways at different times, but that's something that we forget. Sometimes it's more useful to consider that along with a memory, we also in our woven into our brains and the neural structures of our minds, our beings, we also have a forgettery. You know, that we forget that the whole thing is totally unstable and anything can change and anything can happen at any moment and probably will. And as Ajahn Chah was fond of saying, that, you know, death and impermanence are not polite. They don't ask for permission or give us much warning that change is within us, is around us, is present continually. But we have this forgettery. We have this capacity to just push aside that greater view, because we've got things to do, we've got places to go, we've got people to talk to, we've got things to arrange, we've got plans, commitments, and that's, you know, obviously natural and ordinary for us. And there's no harm in taking action and running our lives and looking after each other and taking care of our homes and our work, our families, our friends, our community, fulfilling responsibilities. But the Buddha was acutely aware of how those concerns are easily cut adrift from their context. That yes, it's fair enough to build cabins and, you know, these wonderful structures that have been taking shape on the hillside here, but slowly approaching completion. The stucco guys finally did their final piece today. So these are impermanent buildings. There will come a day when they will slide down the hill or catch fire or crumple to dust, even though it might sound heretical to say so. And the mind is hinged on nearly there, nearly there, they're nearly complete. Well, they won't be complete until they've dissolved into their constituent elements. That's when the buildings will really be complete, is when it's all gone, and even the memory has faded. Oh, this is natural. It's instinctual for us to look after our bodies, our lives, our possessions, our plans, and to commit to that, to do the best we can. And yet the Buddha was aware of how when we, in the process of doing the best we can and fulfilling those connections that we have, those commitments and concerns, the mind gets wrapped into those projects, into those relationships, into those objects. And as they grow and develop and increase, then we feel happy. And as they split apart and break up and fall to pieces, then we find our heart doing the same thing. You tie your heart to a sankhara, a formed object, And as it grows and develops, your heart grows and develops. And as it falls apart, your heart falls apart. This is dukkha. This is completely natural for us. This is ordinary. But if we are continually guided and dominated by that habit, then we are in a continual state of either subtle or coarse sort of anxiety or grief, having lost something that we loved, a person or a reputation or a possession, an opportunity, or even if things are going well, there's that when the moments of it being threatened, or the tension that we have to sustain in order to protect it and keep it and look after it and make sure it's insured and cared for and held, so that it won't be taken away, or if something comes along, threatens to remove it, our health or our loved one or our home or our possessions or our mobility, then that suffering is right there. And exactly to the extent to which we are enmeshed, enchanted, entranced by the conditions, by that particular form, is exactly that, to that degree, that we will experience suffering, and that suffering will appear to be absolutely real and solid. It's really bad, this is really wrong, or it's really unfair, or I'm not ready for this. So a lot of the meditation and both the concentration practices and also the qualities of reflection that we develop are to do with recollecting the greater context of our life and the world and how nature functions. And it's not just with Suhi's brand new, Prius, one of those eco-friendly car. So it's so eco-friendly, it's swiftly returning to the earth element. I don't know if it's salvageable, but it's certainly it's lost its windscreen, it's got a sucking great dent in the roof, and whether it'll continue its life as a car or not, I don't know, but to consider the greater context, the practices and reflections on that we have remind us how the vision gets narrowed, and to basically encourage us over and over and over again to not be pulled by those instinctual grasping and gripping of personal concerns and perspectives, and to broaden the view, because it's a delicate system, and it's not just for Suhi and Dee, but for all of us, in different situations. I mean, just like earlier last year when Tan Panyawuto in Thailand passed away, young monk, not even 40 years old, and seemingly just popping down to use the bathroom early in the morning, and seems to have had some kind of a blackout or a dizzy spell, and then happened to fall and hit his head in a exactly the wrong way, out of a thousand different ways that he could have fallen. He fell in such a way that his head hit the wall at such an angle that his neck snapped, and he was dead before he hit the ground. Apparently, still had his flashlight in his hand. That fast it ended. And it's easy to do. I remember years ago when I was living, I think it was my second, no, third vasa as a bhikkhu. I was in southwest England in this little place in Devon, actually before there was even a Devon monastery. And this couple who were part of the local Devon group had invited a monk and an anagarika to spend the rains retreat down there, and I had gone with one anagarika, and speaking of anitra, we were just living in a trailer in the farmyard, and I managed to set the trailer on fire on the third day of the rains, burn it down to a flatbed. That was a good way to begin the retreat. The whole thing was gone in about 3/4 hour, including about a dozen unique copies of early, absolutely marvelous Ajahn Sumedho talks. The only copies thereof that I was going to listen to during the rains and be inspired by and transcribe. And they all went up in flames. But what I was thinking of was that I used to have a lengthy yoga routine every day, and I found that when I was doing the salute to the sun section of this routine, where you're down on the ground and then you stand up quickly, that I guess my blood pressure was a bit low or some such, and I found that sometimes when I stood up quickly from that, you know, I would get dizzy and sometimes black out, and I didn't make much of this at first, and then one day I did this and I could feel that dizzy feeling coming over me, and then next thing I knew, I was in a crumpled heap about 10 feet away, with my head at a very strange angle, upside down, up against the wall. I thought, this is unexpected. I mean, it was one of those experiences where you open your eyes and you think, what's happened to the room? It's not usually like this. Oh yes, this is the carpet in my face. And realizing, I had been completely unconscious and had fallen without any kind of way of breaking my fall, and just happened to land in a way that I didn't snap anything or seriously damage anything, but could have happened like that, just as it did with Tan Panyawuto. He just happened to have a similar experience, just blacked out, and his head was struck in an unfortunate way, and that was it. His life was suddenly over. So the encouragement of the Buddha is in the face of anicca, in face of uncertainty and the precarious nature of formations, not just our bodies, but the way that the whole of the natural world is, the delicacy with which things come together, and the intrinsically transient, unstable quality of all things. Rather than trying to be comforting and say, don't worry, everything will be all right. It's not really the Buddha's style. It's much more, rather than handing you a lollipop to suck to make you feel better or such like, it's much more an encouragement to look and see, to notice what we're attached to, and to find what there is that is actually stable and trustworthy, what can be relied upon, what can be of genuine benefit, what is dependable in this universe, in this reality. And he realized, this is a very natural human condition that we experience, and that it's normal for us to be oblivious or to be asleep and to not be aware of the bigger context. And he uses this very, in the Dhammapada, he uses this very compelling image. He says, like a flood carrying away a sleeping village. Just also with the deluges that we we had last month, it also kind of brings it to mind of that can be what it's like. You're fast asleep in your bed and you think everything is fine, and then the flood comes down, the river rises, the creek swells to such a degree that the whole village is carried away in the night, and you never knew a thing. It's just before you can do anything about it, suddenly it's all whisked away from us. So, we'd think you'd like some comfort or some reassurance, but it's the only reassurance or the main encouragement the Buddha gives us is to wake up, you know, to understand that if you seek security in that which is intrinsically insecure, you're bound to suffer. So the encouragement is to look for that which is secure. You know, if you make your refuge your house or your insurance policy or your relationships or your body or your possessions or your reputation, your health, your mental faculties, you know, whatever it might be that is formed and dependent, then that has to bring disappointment and insecurity with it. It has to. It's a law of nature. It can't be any other way. It's also kind of interesting when we've been doing a lot of Paritta chanting recently, for particularly for young Todd up in the hospital in Seattle, but various other people as well. And one of the chants that we do, one of the ones that's always done for people in a state of sickness, is what's called the Bojanga Paritta. And this recounts several different incidents from the time of the Buddha, but in particular, one where one or two of the elders are gravely ill. The Venerable Chunda in one instance, and then I think Moggallana in another. And someone goes to the Buddha and says, "Oh, you know, Venerable Chunda's, you know, terribly ill and sick, and you know, is really suffering a lot. Can you help him?" And the implication is that, oh, well, maybe the Buddha can sort of conjure up a little mojo and, you know, relieve the pain or cure him of this illness and help him out. And the Buddha just says, tell him to recollect the seven factors of enlightenment. Yeah, that's what will help him. So again, it's not terribly consoling or comforting. It's not like sort of giving him a little teddy bear to keep him comfortable or even sort of relieving the pain, but just giving him, encouraging him. What's really going to help is recollecting that which is not tied to the born and the dying, the ailing and the formed. Or similarly, when Anatta Pindika was close to death and experiencing a great deal of pain and suffering, what really appreciated was the teachings on emptiness that he was given, of not self and emptiness. That's what was really beneficial, and he was really pleased, glad to hear that. And his, you know, the physical pain, as he said, you know, when Ananda came to see him, says, "How are you doing, householder? I hope your suffering is decreasing and not increasing. I hope your sickness is abating." And in characteristic sort of Sutta style, Anatta Pindika says, "Thank you for your good wishes, Venerable Sir, but my sickness is not decreasing, it is increasing, it is getting worse, and my pains are not diminishing, they are increasing." Yeah. It's as if someone has a leather strap tightened around my head that they're twisting and making more and more tight and painful. But even having said that, then, you know, he gets given these teachings on emptiness, on transcendent wisdom, and that's something that really benefits him, helps him. So this is why the recollection of the refuges is something that's so central to our practice, our whole, you know, spiritual commitment. And it can be something, you know, that we don't really think much of. You know, we do the puja, we think Buddha Dhamma Sangha, yes, very nice, very important. But as soon as we finish the chant, then it's out of the way, or we don't think about it. We're more involved in say, interested in the meditation practice, trying to focus the mind on the breath, or looking at different particular difficulties in our life, or, you know, problems we need to solve, or things that are weighing upon us, or other concerns. But the reason why we keep recollecting and bringing to mind the qualities of Buddha Dhamma Sangha is not just because the terms refer to the Buddha as our teacher, Gautama Buddha, and the Dhamma teaching as the words that he used to guide us and support us. And then the Sangha as those beings who have awakened to the way, who are sort of good companions in the spiritual life and helpful guides and inspiring examples, that those external aspects of Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha are one piece of it, but is the reason why they are a refuge. A refuge is a safe place. That's the whole point of it, is it's dependable. It's something that's that you can rely upon. A refugee is someone who's gone from a dangerous place to where there is safety. So we are, if we are all triple refugees in this, that we are in taking refuge in Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, we're seeking a safe place where there is security. Or the other word that is used, the tisarana, along with the tisarana, the tiratana, the three jewels. A jewel is something that is very beautiful, very precious, but also very hard, obviously not indestructible in material terms, but at least symbolically, like a diamond is certainly the toughest of material forms, that which is strongest, most invulnerable, impenetrable, reliable, as well as being beautiful and symmetrical and valuable. So the Buddha, which is the refuge, Buddha refuge, this is the quality of wakefulness itself, that capacity we have to wake up, to know, to be aware. And this is really the essence of insight meditation. What we're doing when we're developing vipassana is developing that quality of Buddha wisdom, of knowing, of awareness, where there's this recognition that there can be a knowing of happiness and unhappiness, of comfort, of pain, of pleasant feeling, painful feeling, beautiful sounds, ugly sounds, neutral sounds. That which knows the beautiful and the ugly, the pleasant and the painful, the neutral, knows delightful memories, painful memories, delightful ideas, painful ideas, blissful emotions, blissful states of mind, and painful, ugly, awful, heart-wrenching, grief-stricken states of mind. That which knows those qualities, those changes, is not tied up to them, like a mirror reflecting the beautiful, the ugly, the neutral. The mirror is utterly indifferent, is unmoved, is not decorated or embellished by the beautiful, and it's not polluted or corrupted or damaged by the ugly. It just reflects impartially, patiently, purely, easily, effortlessly. It reflects. Ajahn Chah uses a very compelling image of oil and water. So like the mind and its objects, the knowing mind and its objects are intrinsically like oil and water. Because the mind is agitated and confused because of ignorance and desire, governing our perceptions, our habits. This is like the oil and the water shaken up together, like in a bottle of salad dressing. They're all shaken up by our habits of identification, clinging. I am this body, I am these feelings, these are my memories, these are my plans, these are my ideas, these are my friends, these are my enemies, this is my life, and this is where I live, and this is what I do, and who I am. All of that I am, you are, it is the shaking of the bottle, and so it's all mixed up together. When we let things calm down, when the mind is at ease and clear, then the oil and the water separate out from each other. They're intrinsically immiscible. They don't mix if we just let them settle. And the knowing goes to one level, and the objects go to another, like the oil and the water separate out from each other. So when we allow that steadiness, that clarity, that stillness to be established, then there's knowing, and then there is exaltation, there is regret, there is hope, there is pleasure, there is fear, there is delicious tastes, there are bitter tastes. They are the known, they are the objects, mind objects. And that awareness is completely liberated from them, is unentangled. That's why liberation is possible. If they were of a single nature, then liberation would be impossible. It's because that quality is intrinsically transcendent, is not tied to the born and the dying, the changing, because it's of a transcendent quality. The heart can be free, the heart can be truly at ease, the heart can be truly content and be with those changes as they occur, so we can know different experiences. So even with sickness and pain, there can be that full awareness of this is a painful feeling, this is a really painful feeling. But that's why what was relieving to Anathapindika and Chunda, Moggallana and others was not something to take the pain away, which obviously, you know, analgesia is a fine thing. I mean, had a headache for the last week, but I was cheerfully consuming ibuprofen. So I have no ideological objection to pain relief. But there's this, the real pain relief is recognizing that it's not self, and it is not an absolute reality. It's just a transient experience that is essentially empty. And that when the heart rests in that awareness of it, then there may be pain, but there's no suffering. There's no complaint about it. There's no objection to it. There's no feeling of this is unfair or trying to get rid of it in a desperate, agitated, fretful way. You do what you can to work with it, negotiate the situation. But what's out of your control, that you let go of. You don't make any more grief out of that. So that there may be pain, but there's no suffering around it. The heart can be completely at peace with that. And even with the ending of your life, even the mindfulness of a life ending, that deepest of instincts that we have to preserve our own life. Sometimes, you know, the life is ebbing away. The heart has stopped, or the car, you know, like with Suhi and Dee, if the car had slid over the other side, you know, if it had gone over the edge rather than into the ditch, it might have been a very, very different story. But what's the difference, really? There's awareness of the body breathing, and then awareness of the body breathing less and less until there's awareness of the body non-breathing. Now, I'm sure those who are convinced that when the body stops breathing and that the life force departs or ends, that's completely the end of the story. But it's helpful to consider, and certainly within Buddhist teachings, the Buddha's own perspective on it is that quality of awareness is independent from the body. So whether the body happens to a certain body happens to be alive or not alive is kind of beside the point. So this is just to consider this way. I remember having a very powerful experience of this when there was a woman, a nun who was dying of cancer at Amaravati, and I was in her room. We were keeping a vigil going 24 hours a day with her, and I was in her room with about three or four others when she finally passed away. And it was a very, very powerful and clear insight that, you know, there we were, there was a, it was 1:30 in the morning, so that it was very, things were very quiet and still, and we'd all sort of been in, involved in her process of dying for quite a few weeks, and so it was, there was a very strong atmosphere and a very sort of strong, powerful feeling of closeness with us all. And I remember really, it was really so obvious being in that room, that listening to her breathing getting softer and softer, and then the perceptions of my own moods and the physical sensations and the sounds in the room and her breath, and you know, not that I was like reading her mind as such, but just it was completely obvious that as there was a knowing of the sounds of her breath and the movements she was making, getting gentler and gentler, and then knowing the perceptions of my body, knowing the perceptions of her body, the others in the room, then when the body stops breathing, you know, there's absolutely no difference. You know, you think when the death moment comes, there's going to be some sort of big change in the room, or it's like the wind of death rustles the curtains, or some kind of energetic change. But it was even on the external level there was no change, certainly, but more importantly on the internal level it was so clear that it's a perception of a body breathing and a perception of a body not breathing. And how could my perception really be different from hers? You know, it's all just awareness. It's not like Dasaniya's awareness or Chandapala's awareness or Amaro's awareness or Jitapala's awareness. It's just, it's all the same awareness that apparently is located in separate bodies, but its fundamental nature is the same, like water. You know, the water that's in all of our bodies is all, you know, H2O. It's all the same water, but even since we've been in this room, that water vapor that I've breathed out has been breathed in by some of you, and similarly, that water vapor you've breathed out or have sweated, I've breathed in. So that what was, you know, I'm not keeping track of all of this with any little meter or anything, but but we can be pretty sure, to some degree or another, that the Michael and Bruno and Jackie and Dennis, Dhammadaso, Amaro that came in, we've all sort of swapped a few molecules. But your water hasn't got David or Dennis or Amaro or Heidi written in it. It's not personal. It's a one element, one form. So when we take refuge in Buddha, it's that the heart rests in that quality of knowing, awareness. That's what the Buddha means, that awake knowing quality. So when we say Buddhang Saranang Gacchami, that's what it means, is being that knowing in this very moment. And then Dhammang Saranang Gacchami, refuge in Dhamma, whereas the Buddha element refers to the subject side of it, Dhamma represents the object side of it. So it means, Dhamma means nature, the way things actually are, the fundamental reality of things. So that along with Dhamma referring to the Buddha's verbal teachings and so on, it's that recognition of this is the way it works. This is the fabric of it. This is the fundamental quality of all things, mental and physical. So refuge in Dhamma is that acknowledgement. It's that as it were, giving everything back to nature. When we were in Thailand, the abbots, the world abbots meeting that we had in Thailand in January, and different of the elders were recollecting certain teachings or qualities about Lumpur Cha that they found was sort of helpful or inspiring. And one of the Ajahn Kemananda said, what was most powerful and inspiring about Ajahn Chah to him was that he had given everything back to nature. It's like there was this quality of a total attunement of his life to nature, that there wasn't a kind of separateness of a person that was being held, but that Ajahn Chah's whole manner of being was completely in accord with that fundamental quality. So refuge in Dhamma is letting go of the opinions and attitudes of how it should be or could be or how we would prefer things to be, or it's recognizing this is the way nature works. And a complete surrendering of the heart to that. That fundamental reality. That purity of being. Another way that Lumpur Cha described the nature of Dhamma was that Dhamma is those qualities of purity, radiance and peacefulness that arise from Sila, Samadhi and Panya, virtue, concentration and wisdom. So when the Dhamma is experienced directly, when that's known in the heart, that fundamental nature of Dhamma, that basic reality, how we experience it is with these qualities of peacefulness, of purity, of kind of inviolability, and brightness or radiance or a kind of energy, a kind of splendor or resplendent quality. So when the knowing mind sees the way things are, that fundamental quality, when there's an awareness of Dhamma, awareness of the way things are, what comes forth from that? When the Buddha sees the Dhamma, what comes forth is Sangha. What arises from that is Sangha, which is the capacity of the heart to function in accord with nature, to harmonize with things and to harmonize with other beings, other in other conditions. So when we take refuge in Sangha, it's fundamentally the gesture of unselfishness, of the letting go of self-concern, self-centered perspectives, and to the guidance or the committal of action and speech to that quality of accord with Dhamma. So when we describe the qualities of Sangha, Supatipanno, Ujjupatipanno, Nyayapatipanno, Samichipatipanno, etc., those who have practiced well, practiced directly, practiced insightfully, those who practice with integrity, so that what's being taken refuge in is that practice, the doing, that the acting on that, so that when there is that awareness, it's like of Dhamma, then what comes forth from that, the response to that, the way that that realization manifests in the world, in interrelationship, is with these qualities of directness, of integration, of harmony. And even though we split these things up, these qualities up as Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, in sometimes you can say, well, it's actually, just Dhamma aware of its own nature, really. It's like, the Buddha is not really separate from the Dhamma, and the what is the Sangha except those qualities in action. So, you can divide them up or separate them out or not. It's also interesting in the chanting that we do, the astute will have noticed that each time we recite the qualities, for each one of them we say, for me there is no other refuge, the Buddha is my excellent refuge. And then a few minutes later, for me, the Dhamma is my only refuge. And then there is no other refuge. And then a few minutes later, for me there is no other refuge, the Sangha is my excellent refuge. Well, hang on a minute, how can the Sangha be my only refuge if the Dhamma is? Well, I thought the Buddha was my only refuge. But the repetitiousness of it and the matter-of-factness of it is pointing to the fact that these are all unified fundamentally, that the refuge is in this combination of qualities, that and the going for refuge is a choice that we make, is a training, because that we tend to take refuge in our opinions, our moods, our plans, our fears, desires, aversions, our the limitations that we feel we have. Yeah, along with our homes, our jobs, our personalities. These are our familiar refuges. So that part of the purpose of the chanting and the recollection and the continual reiteration and the way one affirms one's intent to practice, to develop spiritual training around the Buddha Dhamma, taking refuge, it's like a conscious reminding of ourselves to lay aside, to not be confused or entranced by the habitual refuges, protecting the body, cultivating our friends, caring for our loved ones, looking after our possessions, pursuing a career, making our insurance payments, etc., etc. Yeah. That these are not the dependable refuge. And so that's why we recite these words. For me, there is no other refuge. The Dhamma is my excellent refuge. For me, there is no other refuge. Because, if we don't reflect, then we find that we're just drawn into all the other 10,000 refuges of owning property or our life plans or our friendships, our dear ones. So that when we recite these words, it's designed to hold up a mirror to those other refuges that we are so fond of, that are so familiar with, that we really fear will be taken away from us. And even if we don't really believe it when we say those words, this is my only refuge, it's at least planting the seed, at least that feeling of threat, like, well, actually, it's not really my only refuge. I've got a few things parked away there that I don't want to let go of, or that I really trust in and cherish. But it's raising up that possibility, it's holding a mirror up to those inferior or unstable or not unreliable refuges. And saying, look, don't depend on these, because they're going to let you down and it's going to bring disappointment. Whereas it's also in the same gesture, it's encouraging that, look, this is what's dependable. The Dhamma is not subject to destruction. Nature, in its essence, is always going to be here. It's the fundamental principle of all things. It can't go anywhere. It is everywhere. It is everywhereness, everythingness. It's reliable. It's dependable. Remember this. And so that the Buddha's encouragement is not to wait until the car is turning over. You're sliding backwards down the hill and the car is turning over. This is not the time to begin cultivating the refuges. It's when we have our faculties and we have a bit of control and some choice and we can steer our life. This is the time to cultivate those contemplations, those reflections, to cultivate refuges, to cultivate that realization of Dhamma, to really let it soak into our bones, into our cells, to let that recognition of what is truly dependable, what is truly reliable, what is truly a refuge, what is truly of value, truly our foundation. So then, you know, when if that's really brought home and is there in our hearts, in our soaked into us in a cellular level, then when the car starts to slide down the hill and turn over, then what comes to mind is that realization of those qualities. You know, that they, in those moments, that's what springs up. Rather than, as they say in the most common final words that they hear on the black box recordings of airplanes, you know, airliners, when they go down, they find the black box and the flight recorder. More often than not, the final words of the pilot are, "Oh shit." That's it. So let that not be our last. The last place that our mind takes refuge, as the curtain on Act 5, Scene 5 closes, but to instead to have that quality of realization of Dhamma, like, oh yeah, well, it's just that which was has always been impermanent is changing. That's all. It's just the five khandhas coming and going, changing. What's that got to do with anything real? The heart lets go. Everything is fine. And the changes take place as they will. Because the refuge has been truly and firmly established. So on this memorable evening of the overturning vehicle. These are some thoughts to contemplate and to recollect, to let soak into the heart. When the ego is faced with uncertainty, it responds with fear and the search for comfort. But when the heart encounters uncertainty, the unknown, it responds with wonderment. There's a quality of delight. Of course everything is uncertain. There's no sense of threat. Whereas if we relate to life from an egoic position, and always what comes forth is that quality of fear, and then out of fear springs desire, and the whole wheel starts spinning. So let this occasion be a good lesson, a reminder, and an encouragement for all of us to relate to our experiences of uncertainty, of the unknown, from that place of selflessness. And so then we meet the same world, the same array of changes and transiency, that same instability, but the heart can rest in that quality of wonderment, of the mystery of it all. Who knows what's going to happen? And this is the place of invulnerability, of true security. So I offer these thoughts for consideration.